the book of Esther. It's in the Old Testament. You can open to the first chapter, and we're going to read a few verses shortly. I want to start just by mentioning a quick story. It's my favourite Sunday school moment. A couple of years ago in Sunday school, we were playing a game where I would think of a letter from the alphabet, say it was the letter J, and all the kids in the Sunday school would have to think of a name from the Bible beginning with that letter. When they'd thought of a name, they could stand up. And then I will go through my memory and think of all the names in the Bible beginning with that letter. And if I spoke the name that each of the children had thought up, they had to sit down. And the idea was they had to beat me. When I ran out of names, whoever was left standing, they had to tell me their name. And if it was the name in the Bible, they got a prize. One Sunday, I selected the letter S. So everybody stood up. I went through all the different names in the Bible. Samson, Sarah, Saul, Sennacherib, Sanballat. I got through, and there was only about three or four left, which there normally were. Normally the older ones think of the names that are totally obscure. The little ones at the front normally think of the names like Stephen, the real popular names. Anyway, there was a little boy down the front who was standing there with his hands in his pockets, proud as punch, and you could tell that he was pretty chuffed with himself. And he kept looking down the back at the older ones thinking, hey, I'm the only little one left. So I thought, well, we'll go through and see what everyone had. And I went through the ones at the back, and they all had the obscure names that I didn't know of or had forgotten about. And I came to Matthew. And I said to Matthew, did you think up this name on your own? He said, yeah. And you could tell he was very pleased with himself. So I said, okay, Matthew, tell us the name. And proud as a punch, he said, Esther. So I gave him a prize anyway, because I thought it was pretty clever, even if he did get his spelling a little bit wrong. The book of Esther is a very interesting book. It's a very inspiring book. It's a wonderful book. And I think it's very often quite neglected. We don't really hear much about it. And it's one of those books that sort of seems to be buried in the Old Testament. I think if Hollywood got hold of it, it would make a tremendous blockbuster movie. It's got a great plot line. It's got great characters. But tonight we shall suffice with just half an hour talk on the book of Esther. So, I thought we'd start off firstly by looking at the time and the place. John and Dave spoke the last few weeks on Ezra and Nehemiah, and it's in roughly the same time as that. You can see in 536 BC, just around about 500 years before the Lord came to earth, the Jews, led by Zerubbabel, returned from Babylon to Jerusalem. And from that time till about 516 BC, the temple began to rebuild, and Ezra's time was around about there. In 486 BC, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus, began his reign over Persia. Persia at that time was the world dominating power. It had the most power over all the world, and Xerxes therefore was probably the most powerful man that lived on the earth at the time. He began his reign in 486 BC. So around about 8 years into his reign, we have the setting of this book, when Esther becomes the queen. 5 years later, after she became queen, in 473 BC, Esther saved the Jews from their massacre that was planned. And then in 464, Xerxes, I'm going to call him Xerxes because it's easier to say than Ahasuerus, his reign ends. And then about 20 years after that, history tells us that Nehemiah begins rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. So you can see where the book fits into history. Dave mentioned when he spoke that Esther's actual time period falls between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of the book of Ezra. I just said there, therefore Esther appears about 40 years after the temple was rebuilt and about 30 years before the wall of Jerusalem was built. Also, just as a point of interest, this is roughly the same time as the prophets Haggai, Zechariah and Malachi. So we sort of get a bit of an idea of where this story happens in history. Okay, I've drawn a bit of a map. I hope. Oh, it doesn't turn out too bad. Better than I thought. Of where Susa, or another name for the city, is Shushan. This book of Esther occurs pretty much totally in this city of Shushan, or it's also called Susa. It was the winter residence generally of the kings, and you can see, and I have to refer to my notes here, that the Mediterranean Sea is here, Israel, Judah and Jerusalem are over here, Egypt's down this way, that's the Caspian Sea, and I've got the wrong sheet of paper here, that's the Persian Gulf, yes, down the bottom here, that's the river, the Tigris River, that's the Euphrates, and so we can see where it generally fits in. Now I know this is Iran today, but we don't have a atlas at home, so I can't tell you. I'm not sure where Iran comes around and where its borders are, so we get a rough idea of where Esther lived and the place in which she lived. Okay, I'll get my next slide. So we've got the time and place. I thought we'd just have a look at some of the before we go through each of the chapters, I thought we'd just look at some of the characters that we will be learning about in the book. And there's really five main characters. Firstly, the king. His name is, as I said, Ahasuerus, or Xerxes. He's the ruler of Persia, and he reigned for around about 20 years. His wife was Queen Vashti. She was the queen who, we're going to find out through the book in chapter 1, who dared to defy the king. As a result of that, Hadassah, her Hebrew name, or Esther, rose to become the queen. Her cousin was Mordecai. He was an older cousin to Esther, and he became the prime minister of Persia. I don't know if the prime minister was his proper title, but he was second to the king, sort of like a prime minister. And of course, the last man is man Haman. He was prime minister to Ahasuerus or Xerxes, and we're going to read as we go through the chapters how he was put to death. So what we'll do now, we'll just go through chapter by chapter, and what I've done on the board here, I've just listed a few of the highlights from each chapter, but if you open up to chapter 1, let's read a few verses. We'll read some verses from each of the chapters, and for the next 10 minutes or so, just go through the book and see what the story, how it all unfolds. So let's read Esther chapter 1. And read from verse 1. Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendour of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Susa, the capital, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were hangings of fine white and violet linen, held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns, and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. And the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion. For so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So the book starts off by telling us about the great feast. Now apparently this feast may have been a feast that was given just before Xerxes was on his way to conquer the Greeks. He never did conquer the Greeks. He spent his life trying, but he never did succeed. And I'm not sure of the time, it's in the 300 BCs somewhere. Alexander the Great rose up and overcame the Persian Empire, and so began the reign of the Greek Empire. But this banquet apparently was given just before one of his setting out to battle against the Greeks. You can see from verse 4 and 5, they're very descriptive of the fine banquet, and it must have been a very rich and royal affair indeed. During this feast, through the rest of the chapter, Xerxes was showing all the greatness and the beauties of his kingdom. He was the most powerful and no doubt the richest man in the world at this time, and he was parading all of his beautiful things through to show his guests. And in doing so, he calls his queen, Queen Vashti, to come and show her beauty to the guests. Now, Vashti refused to do this, probably because he was asking her to unclothe herself, and so it was probably for her a very wise thing to do. And in his foolishness, he asked her to come forward. She refused, and after the king spoke with some of his so-called wise men, they decided to banish Queen Vashti and to make her an example to all women so that they obeyed their husbands. They thought if this gets out to the nation, women everywhere will be doing their own thing and defying their husbands. So they thought this was the smartest option to take, and so Queen Vashti was banished. That's chapter 1. In chapter 2, after a period of time, in chapter 2 verse 1, I'll just read that. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Some of the writers, when they're commenting on these verses here, say that they may mention that there is a bit of sorrow on the behalf of King Ahasuerus about what he'd done. Now, it doesn't specifically say that, but it may have been the case that he was sorry for banishing Queen Vashti. He doesn't recall her back, and that's the last we hear of her. And what happens next is that the royal men, the wise men, go out throughout the land, and they basically have a national beauty contest to find Miss Persia. And what they do, they go throughout the land and try to find the most beautiful women to bring before the king to make a new queen, a new wife for him. Let's read verse 15. We see, now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favour in the eyes of all who saw her. Esther, no doubt, was a very beautiful young woman, and she was selected to join the king's concubines and perhaps become the queen. And so verse 16 tells us, Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favour and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. And so we see in chapter 2 how Esther is chosen to be the queen, but she, upon being advised by Mordecai, does not tell anybody that she is a Jew. And just at the end of the chapters, in the last few verses there, we see, as a bit of a footnote, that Mordecai was able to save the king's life by revealing a plan to kill the king. And it just mentions there that he made it known to the king so the king's life was spared. Moving to chapter 3, Haman was a member of the... He was a Persian, and he became the prime minister. And as a result of him being promoted to prime ministership, he was honoured by the king, and all people had to bow before him whenever he passed by. Mordecai was the only one who refused to bow down to him. He stood up whenever Haman went past, and because of this, Haman's pride was aroused, and he took it personally and was very bitter towards Mordecai. And once he found out that Mordecai was a Jew, he was bitter against the Jews, and so He devises a plan and presents a plan to the king. Doesn't exactly say who the people were, but he intends to annihilate the whole Jewish nation. And so a plan is put into progress to destroy all Jews. All of this because Mordecai refuses to bow down. In chapter 4, Mordecai and the Jews learn of this decree that the king has issued, a decree that cannot be changed, and chapter 4 starts off with the Jewish nation mourning and lamenting their coming annihilation that has been decreed. Excuse me. As you read through the chapter, you'll see how Mordecai instructs Esther to plead the case for the Jews to Xerxes, and we'll read those verses from verse 6 of chapter 4. So Hathach went out. Hathach was one of Queen Esther's aides. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and to order her to go into the king to implore his favour and to plead with him for her people. Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. And they related Esther's words to Mordecai. And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, nights or a day. And I and my maidens also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. And so we see Esther comes up to meet the king. In chapter 5, Esther approaches the king. He extends her scepter, thus saving her life. And she invites the king and his prime minister Haman to a feast. And the latter half of the chapter tells us how Haman, the prime minister, goes out thinking he was very special for being invited to the feast. And as he leaves, he sees Mordecai refusing to bow down again. And in his anger, he goes home and devises a plan to hasten Mordecai's destruction, not leave it until the nation is destroyed, but to bring it about quickly. In chapter 7, are we up to chapter 7? Sorry, we're up to chapter 6. Xerxes cannot sleep during the night, and he is reminded, or he brings the book of the Chronicles of the Kings before him, and he is reminded as they read to him that Mordecai had saved his life, and he wonders what has been done to reward Mordecai. He's been telling him nothing has been done, and so the king thinks, how can I reward this man's kindness to me? In the morning, Haman comes in to try to hasten Mordecai's destruction, get permission from the king, and the king says to him, "What shall be done unto the man who the king delights to honour?" Haman, thinking it was himself, chooses and thinks of a great honour to be led through the palace, led through the city, with on the king's horse, with the king's garments on, being where's the verse here? And it being shouted before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king desires to honour." Haman thinking it will be to himself, and imagine his bewilderment when the king says to him, "Go and get the horse and get the garments and put them on Mordecai, and you go before him." I can imagine how much Haman's face would have fallen when he heard that, and so he goes out and does that, and his whole day is ruined, and it only gets worse. In chapter 7, Esther invites the king and Haman to another feast. And it is here at this feast that the truth is revealed about the plans and the dealings to destroy the Jewish nation. And Haman is totally beaten as the king realizes that Haman was not only out to destroy the Jewish nation, but his queen and Mordecai as well. And so he is taken out and hung on the gallows that he had actually built to put Mordecai on. It's quite a turnaround. It's amazing. Chapter 8, Mordecai is honoured again, and Xerxes' decree is overruled. And we might take time. No, we better not take. Better not read. Haven't got time for it. We see that the Jews rejoice when they see that the decree is overruled. And yes, we will read because it's a very good verse. Verse 17. And in each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the people of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. So many turned and become proselytes, I guess, because of what had happened. And so we see in chapter 9, on the day that the nation was supposed to be destroyed, they, according to the decree from the king, were allowed to defend themselves. And what actually happened was that the Jewish nation was able to destroy many of their enemies that were out to get them. So it was a wonderful day for the Jewish nation, for Israel. And we see also at the end of the chapter that such was their joy that a new feast was instituted, the Feast of Purim. Now that comes from, the title of that feast comes from the fact that when Haman was selecting the best time to destroy the Jews, he was casting what they call pur, and I can only imagine it was like dice. I'm not sure if it was or not, but they called it pur. And he was waiting for the right time to be revealed through this pur, this dice system. And that's when the day was selected. It obviously didn't turn out as he planned, and so the Jews remember the Feast of Purim, or the Feast of Lots, and they remember it each year. It's around about, I think it's the time of February, March in the year. I'm not sure about that. And just in the last chapter, that's a very short chapter, three verses, that you see Mordecai's greatness is. He's honoured again, and his greatness is told of how, what a wonderful person he is and all that he's done. And truly he was a brave man and a strong man to stand up when he should have bowed down. Okay, I've got a couple minutes left. And I've just got a few points of interest and then a few lessons for us today. A few points of interest about the book. I guess if anybody had a trivia night and they asked a question about Esther, this question would be in it. How many times is God mentioned in the book? You think, surely, four times, Mr. Green says. Well, God's name is not directly mentioned, I don't think. Obviously, we can have a question about this and some discussion later. I couldn't find any direct mentions of God. I couldn't even find an obscure reference. In chapter 4, verse 14, what I thought would have been the best reference for God to make an appearance, Mordecai says, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. God's name is not mentioned in the book. I guess the best reason that I can come up for it is a lesson for us that God works behind the scenes. And I was thinking just tonight that it is an encouraging thought, particularly in Australia, where we don't see a great revival happening as they do in other parts of the world, but God is still working. And even though it's not a great movement that is seeing many people saved or many people becoming Christians, God is still working. And through this book we see God working behind the plans in keeping the king awake so Mordecai can be remembered. We see God working through the plans as Esther comes before the king and him accepting her into his presence. In many ways, God is at work. I was thinking when I started doing the study of Esther, I think it's a good book to speak about, but then I was thinking, hey, why is the book in the Bible? It just seems to be a good story. But the more I studied it and the more I thought about it, it is more than a great story. It is a fantastic story, but it's a very important historical lesson and a very important piece of history where we see the Jews spared. And it is right up there in the great deliverances with the Exodus, with Noah being spared. It is a great deliverance and it is a great historical fact how they were spared. Can you imagine if they were just if they were destroyed as it was supposed to have been done, God's plans would have come to nothing with the coming Messiah and with our salvation. So it is a very important historical point that is brought up in this book. Now, a couple of just interesting points. Nehemiah was a cupbearer to Ahasuerus' son, Artaxerxes. So we see that Xerxes' son, there was a very close link between the two. And I wonder if Esther knew Nehemiah at all. Nehemiah obviously would have worked in the palace, and I wonder if Esther was still alive at this time. It's just interesting to note how closely they are related. And I just brought there, Esther brought popularity to the Jews, and we see in that verse in chapter 8 how they many became Jews. And I wonder if it was even through her influence that allowed Nehemiah to be free from his duties as a cupbearer to go and rebuild the wall. It's just something I thought was interesting there. And of course, this book, and it's probably the main reason that it is in the Old Testament scriptures, it tells us of the inauguration of the Feast of Purim, or the Feast of Lots, as recorded in chapter 9. Okay, two more minutes. Some lessons for us today. Firstly, chapter 4, verse 14. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? I really enjoyed just these last few words, for such a time as this. Sometimes I wonder why I'm a hydrographer. It's not a job that is helping people. It's not a job that is really doing anything. And if our branch that I work at closed in, nobody would notice. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And this verse really encouraged me that who knows that we are doing, we are where we are for such a time. And maybe that time hasn't come where we have to really stand up for the Lord. Maybe it has come and we've missed it. Maybe we have an opportunity each day to stand up for the Lord. But are we ready when such a time comes to stand up for the Lord? Sometimes we don't know why we are where we are, why we've gone through what we're going through, but God has a plan. And are we ready to stand up and to be counted and to show our faith? And I was just thinking of that verse, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful, yet to those who have been trained by it afterwards, it yields a peaceful fruit of righteousness. Can you imagine Esther as she was in the temple knowing that she had to go before the king? She hadn't been invited before the king for 30 days, and knowing just by the simple fact of whether he put the scepter in front of her or not, that's, her life was in that balance, and yet she was willing to go for such a time as this. God has his plans and he will work them out. The second point and the second verse that I really enjoyed, and it's a famous one, I said to Melody we should put this on our front door just before we walk out every day. If I perish, I perish. Are we willing? How far are we willing to stand up for the Lord? Have we come to the same point as Esther, ready to sacrifice ourselves to save others? Obviously, the Lord Jesus gave us a prime example of that, and he has told us to follow him. And just a verse that encouraged me as I thought about this, we all know it so well. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. It's not a matter as we go out to work and as we go to witness for the Lord that we'll perish, because we know that we won't perish. We have everlasting life. And so, do we have the right attitude, and is it ready to work out in our actions? And just finally, sorry to take up some time, but Mr. Green said he had no questions, so I can take a few more minutes, I'm sure. That verse that I read in chapter 8, many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews, the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. God works behind the scenes to save his people, ensuring that the Messiah will come to redeem them in all nations. Who did God choose? An old Jewish man, Mordecai, and a young Jewess, Esther, to become the queen. They were ready to stand up, and they had courage. And look what happened. Even in that day, many of the people became converted to the Jewish faith. And so today, if we are willing to stand up, I wonder what could happen as if we stand up as we should do. Okay, that's all I had to say. Trust you've learned something and enjoyed it. It's been a good book. I've enjoyed the study of it.